Today we are joined by Richard Salzman. He's a professor of political economy at Duke University. He's also a senior scholar at the Atlas Society. He's the host of our monthly Morals and Markets seminars for students and recent graduates. Richard, great to see you.
Great to be here again. Thanks, Jack.
We're doing an Ask Me Anything on capitalism. So to make this fun, folks, we need your engagement. Raise your hand, ask a question, and Richard will answer it. Fortunately, we also to fill in the lulls in the conversation, we have a lot of questions from our Instagram audience that are up your alley, Richard. And one of them is Maxi Kiyavasa asking, is there anything salvageable of the entirety of Marx's work?
Well, that's a good question. Salvageable. One of the things that might be considered salvageable is the broader notion that you cannot understand social systems without knowledge of philosophy, politics, and economics. So Marx was definitely in that camp. So was Keynes, by the way. So it isn't necessary to be pro-capitalist to at least have a perspective that says, listen, you have to have a certain view of human nature, human motivations, how people produce or don't produce, in the Marxist terminology, how exploitation or alienation occurs, even things like stages of development from feudalism to capitalism to socialism. So I say that because that has largely been lost, except in certain pockets of intellectual activity today. I'm in a program at Duke called PP&E, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. So there are approaches that try to be more integrated, but that is a part of Marxism that I've actually all along admired. And so the idea of siloing our knowledge in very narrow territories where people cannot really talk to each other is a has been a bad trend. I think another way of looking at Marxism is the recent, and by that I mean last 50 years or so, preoccupation with the environmentalist approach, what Ayn Rand called the New Left. It's a critique of capitalism, but so different from the old left, and the old left being Marxism, that the Christians, at least the Marxists, cared about us of labor. They thought only manual labor created value, but at least they were focused on creating material wealth. They had wrong theories about this, but the preoccupation of the Greens, of course, is to not have growth at all or to have anti-growth. The preoccupation in Marxism with the industry, industrialization, things like that, all good things, which in more recent times have been denigrated. So those are the kind of things that I think make debates with Marxists today, or discussions or engagement, a lot more interesting than with non-Marxists. That's just a couple of things.
And he did have a critique on religion, so I think that's
Yes, and
something to mix.
yeah, good point.
All right. Well, thanks for the raised hands. We're going to get to some questions. I also would love to invite you all to share this room. I always get a great deal out of our conversations with Professor Salzman, and I would love for others to be introduced to him. So please share the room with your network. Clark. Clark, did you have a correct question for Professor Salzman? We can't hear you, Clark. You may need to kind of get out of the app and then come back in, as sometimes happens. I also want to recognize my frequent co-host, and partner in crime, Scott Schiff, is in the room, and the founder of our organization, David Kelly. Lawrence, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you. Hi, Richard. My question is, I guess I was a bit too young when, you know, the 2008 market crash and the whole housing bubble that occurred. So I never really understood that as much. But I've been hearing a lot of people talk about as of late that we might have another big drop in the housing market. And I was curious if you thought so, or what are sort of the things that the government might try to do in response?
Well, the first thing I think is worth noting is that the false interpretation of what happened in 08, it's a very common, 08, 09, really. It's a very common interpretation to speak of that as a market failure. Sometimes greed from Wall Street, irrationality of homeowners and things like that. The speculation on Wall Street, stuff like that. It was actually caused by government intervention. There was a explicit policy, starting with Clinton, but then accelerated by George W. Bush, to promote home ownership. They reversed cause and effect. They looked at people who owned homes, and they saw that they had good jobs and stable marriages and things like that, didn't use drugs and had graduate degrees and stuff, and said, well, when we need to put more people in homes. Instead of homes as the effect, they saw homes as the cause. And then they artificially promoted through government agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the FHA, elsewhere, home ownership for those who couldn't afford homes. And so this went on for about a decade or so, and until the whole thing collapsed. Because of course, you can't fudge reality. You can't make people afford homes that they can't afford. So that's the first thing that should be recognized, that and unfortunately it hasn't been, that those agencies still exist. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the government policy of promoting homeownership still exists. By the way, homeownership rates fell. By the time the whole thing was over, they were lower than when they began. So the whole central planning kind of project was a disaster. By the way, very common today, you'll hear things like, shouldn't we have an energy policy? Well, you know, what is our housing policy? What is our fill-in-the-blank policy? Well, you know, the very concept of a national policy of anything should raise suspicions in people's minds. Whether the, by the way, the phraseology of bubble itself, I'm always leery to endorse that view, because it's the idea that it's a fake increase. Well, all changes in prices, even if they're outsized, which is really what people mean by bubbles, have some cause. And the question is whether the cause is taken away or not. So, but it is very common to see any kind of price rise in anything seen in the free market as a fake and unsustainable. And that can be a problem as well, because it makes people invite intervention. They'll say to the policymakers, hey, there's a bubble over here. You need to pop that bubble. And that's something that also elicits very dangerous, deleterious policies. And I wouldn't say today that housing prices are so outsized that they're anything akin to what was true in 2007, 2008. So if you're asking about that particular sector, no, I don't think so. I mean, mortgage rates are going up. They bottomed at 3. They're back up to 5.5 or so. So that is going to put a curb on people borrowing to buy homes. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. The overall policy coming from Biden is very anti-capitalist, but largely in the sector of energy. Anti-fossil fuels, and I've talked about that before. That's a very dangerous policy. And of course, the Federal Reserve is on a policy that's ultimately going to cause a recession, because they already caused an inflation. And they know of no other way of fighting inflation except by fighting the economy, by fighting prosperity and throwing it into recession. We could talk about that separately, but those are the two main problems today: are anti-fossil fuel policy and the Federal Reserve's anti-prosperity policy.
All right. Clark, you want to give it a try again?
Yes. Sorry about that earlier. I was having some Bluetooth problems or something. But yes, thanks so much for having this, Richard and Jag. Actually, my question, Richard, to you would be, you know, I guess to piggyback on Lawrence's question, I'm assuming that this recession, I'm assuming you believe there'll be a recession at some point. Well, my question is how bad will it be? And it just seems like this time, if it is a worse recession than the big one back in 08, 07, 08, 09, is the country strong enough to deal with this? I mean, there's so much anger now between our different political tribes, and things, at least up to now, haven't been all that bad. I mean, we kind of have been living beyond our means and trying to spend our way to prosperity. But, you know, when things go down, will things politically get worse? Or, I mean, is there any chance that the country will finally look towards freedom? You know, you've got a great book, of course, Where Have All the Capitalists Gone? I mean, that has both the answers to what's probably going to happen. And, of course, the answers to, why we shouldn't have been doing what we've been doing for the last, generation or so. So I guess I'm just curious to hear what you think about, how things, how bad things will get. And when they do get bad, is America strong enough to get through?
Thank you, Clark. I think that regardless of whether the next recession, which is around the corner, by the way, in the next 2 years, there'll definitely be one, maybe even in the next year. The depth and duration of it may not match what was seen in 08, 09, but you're right to suspect that even so, it will just further weaken the United States. That's true. I think it's akin to someone going through a series of heart attacks. And recessions and crashes are like that, and they weaken the underlying organ that's giving life and to the body politic, so to speak. Now, why are these happening? It's as in a patient who's got not chronic or genetic problems, but lifestyle problems. It's a lifestyle problem in the United States. The welfare state is unsustainable. The mass redistribution of wealth and power that the welfare state represents is not only unjust and unfair to those who produce values and have them taken, but it's not sustainable in a practical sense. It erodes the vitality and sustainability of the economy. The much more dangerous thing, Clark, is the reaction to these problems. If after, say, 2001, the recession and 9/11 attacks, or the reaction to 2008-09, the financial crisis, or the reaction to 2020, the three huge heart attacks, if you will, were that we need more capitalism, not more statism, I would be more optimistic. But in each of those cases, we've largely seen either no rational response on the part of the government or a doubling down of its irrationality, either on foreign policy or financial policy, or in the case of COVID, epidemiology, public health policy. So when the next recession comes and you see the same old, namely greed did it, capitalism did it. You see it now even in the analysis of inflation, that it's being blamed on greed. It's being blamed on, big meat and big pharma and big tampon and big whatever. I mean, this kind of Marxist crap about inflation being caused either by greed, which is not a cyclical factor. Greed is always there. It just doesn't come and go with price increases and price decreases. That is the real troubling thing, that the diagnostics, so to speak, are wrong. Therefore, there's not going to be a remedy. And the last thing I think I would add to this is, if you look at barometers, three I would name, the value of the dollar. I mean, that is a kind of summary measure of how the United States is doing. It's like the U.S. stock price. And then things like the debt, the national debt, would be another one. And they're all and the money supply, they're all skyrocketing. This is not increases in production. This is increase in financial stuff that the government dickers with because it's trying to finance the welfare state. It knows it cannot finance the welfare state by taxation fully because there'd be tax revolts. So there's this kind of schizophrenia going on. The American people simultaneously want big, huge government, but they don't want to pay for it. Or they want the fat cats, so to speak, to pay for it. Well, there aren't enough fat cats anymore. There just aren't any. So short of taxing, the only thing left for the government is to borrow the money and print the money. And that's what they've been doing in a massive way in the last 20 years. They've been massively printing money and borrowing money. And the chickens are coming home to roost. If you do that, the value of money must fall. The value of the bonds must fall. That means interest rates go up. That means the purchasing power of money goes down. That means inflation and prices go up. So these are the kind of things that ultimately ruin advanced economies. So that is happening, and you can see it, and it's not a good trend. But it's fundamentally, though, an anti-capitalist trend. That's what's causing this. I think the danger on the horizon would be something like World War III. Wars are well known to enormously increase money supply and debt. So on top of what has already occurred, even in quote-unquote peacetime in the last 20 years, were there to be anything equivalent to a World War III, the U.S. would probably go bankrupt.
All right. On that optimistic note, JP.
Lawrence was here first. I'm not sure.
Lawrence asked his question.
I have a question today. I've always not liked capitalism a system because in getting to the source and the history of the word, it was originally coined, I think, by Adorno, and the authority of the phenomena of the Industrial Revolution, and then it was picked up in Das Kapital by Marx, and then we all started. It's one of those words that that are taken over by the mainstream. But there were no theorists of capitalists. There were no thinkers that, okay, there wasn't a capitalist or a free market that ever said capitalism and this is our system. So it's to me, capitalism is more of a phenomena. It's something that happens when free people are free to trade, to build, and to transact without coercion. So it's a phenomena. It's a natural phenomena because it happens when society is free. And so to call it a system is something that always bugs me, and I wanted to get your impression on that.
Thank you, JP. I think it's very important to conceive of it as a system. I think one of the now you call it a phenomenon. Phenomenon, I suppose, just means a more narrower thing. But it's a broader system, and I think it's actually broader than the typical definition we get, which is that it's a political system. That it's an economic system. So standardly, if you ask people about capitalism, they'll start talking about free markets. Some of them will say, don't use the word, use the word free enterprise. Of course, the word capital itself is an economic concept. So I'll speak about that in a moment because I've written on this, the etymology of capitalism, of the phrase, the word itself. But I think it's very important the way Rand put it. She called it a social system. Now, that's a broader concept. A social system would include politics, culture, economics. I would include even psychology. There's a certain psychology. There's a certain type of person, a person of self-esteem and confidence that feels more natural under capitalism than elsewhere. And so it's more than, and the way I put it in my book, it's more than and better than just an economic system. And even the critics of capitalism will recognize this by saying, well, it's got this ethos. It's got this money-making, materialistic, individualistic, secular approach. Even the conservatives will oppose it for that reason. It's a concept definitely worth defending. I have pinned up on the, or I passed on to Jennifer, a link to an essay I wrote on the etymological basis of capitalism. Now, capitalism as a word wasn't coined until 1850, and by Louis Blanc, who's a French socialist, and it was not coined by Marx, and Marx didn't actually use the phrase much at all. And I, in that essay, actually defend the idea of using capitalism, being unapologetic about it. It's true that its critics were the ones who first started using it. But in the same way that Ayn Rand took back or tried to take back the word self-interest or selfishness and defend it, I think similarly we should do this with capitalism. But etymologically, it might interest people to know that capital, and if you think of all the derivations of anything with cap in it, C-A-P, means the head, captain, the capital of a country. And I think the way that Ayn Rand conveyed capitalism as the system that protects, promotes, and encourages, that encourages the men of the mind, the creators, the inventors, the scientists, and the industrialists, it's a wonderful word in a way if you understand the roots of capital itself. And capital, of course, is something that makes our lives more productive, but the word capital itself can be broadly construed, as economists have, at things like human capital. What is human capital? Your skills, abilities, and experience. What is intellectual capital? Things like patents and copyrights. What's tangible capital? Those are like plant and equipment. Financial capital, the stock market, the bond market. So capital itself, a very life-sustaining phenomenon, because it comes from the head, it comes from the cap. So I do know that there is resistance in the, call it the pro-liberty movement, especially among certain libertarians, to jettison the word entirely. And I think the main reason is they think of it as, well, it's a system of just that favors capitalists. And so get rid of the word for that reason. But the words they substitute, like free enterprise, you could say, well, that's just a system of enterprisers. So either way, if you get to the origins of why capitalism is hated, I don't believe it's because of the words. If you called it, you know, schmaltzalism, and then said, you know, it's really based on egoism, individualism, the profit motive, they would hate that word. You know, so it's not the semantics of it that are making people oppose the system. It's the underlying philosophy and the distrust of rational egoism, I believe.
Thanks. Yeah, I would add, you know, I am a part of this Abundance 360 community, which Peter Diamandis invited me to. And it's really a bunch of entrepreneurs, people who have startups. And I was pretty shocked to find so many of them so kind of bought into all of these woke concepts and diversity, equity, inclusion, blah, blah, blah. And I think it's important, especially when talking to people who are looking to start businesses, entrepreneurs, to use the word capitalism, because they at least understand capital. They understand investment capital, venture capital, and just trying to make the case that there is no capitalism, no companies without capital to invest and to build them. So, yeah.
I just want to add that another example of this, which is very humorous to me, a very popular speaker on the circuit these days is Deirdre McCloskey, who's a very productive academic, and she does the same, and she's pro-liberty, and she says we shouldn't call it capitalism, we should call it innovism, and innovism comes from innovation. Now she's right that a free society and a free economy will reward and protect those who are innovative. But see, you would get the same objection. Someone would say, well, that's a system just for innovators. That's unfair. What about the non-innovators? You know, what about the people who can't innovate? They're going to be left behind. Either we are going to get this objection, and you're not going to escape this by coming up with cute alternative words, I don't believe. It's a kind of anti-intellectual approach to the whole thing. Another way of thinking of this would be, if someone said to you, I'm a socialist, you know that they're an advocate of the system of socialism. You would not say, wow, they must be sociable, or they go to social clubs, or they believe in social networks. And interestingly, until recently, I actually think until Rand, if you said I'm a capitalist, it meant you're a financier, that you're like a venture capitalist, or you worked on Wall Street. So notice the bias that on the one hand, you had socialists advocating socialism, but what about a capitalist who advocates capitalism as an idea? So in other words, an ideological capitalist. The fact that those two terms are not interchangeable is very interesting. We should get to a point where the minute someone hears, I'm a capitalist, the broader public thinks of it as, wow, they're advocating the system of capitalism, but as understood by Ayn Rand, not by the crony capitalist types.
All right. Hansen?
Yeah, thank you very much. I actually agree with you on every point. I just wonder if it seems that if we want to reach the state of free market capitalism, we have to convince the majority of the population to basically abandon the statism and then reliance on the on big government. I mean, how do we do that? I mean, it seems that we just have to convince them, I guess, and vote out the policies that that interfere with the economy. It seems to be a long road to that, especially considering the present state of resurgent socialism and the wokeism and liberalism, and I mean the progressive social warrior and all that nutty idiocies. So it seems quite. I don't know if I should characterize my view as pessimism. It seems that we are walking backwards from the, say, 80s when Milton Friedman advocated the free market capitalism, and seemed to have progressed pretty far, let's say, or measurable steps forward in that direction, let's say. Now we are regressing, what do you think of, what's your take on the current situation and what the future holds for the U.S.?
Well, thank you, Hansen. My current assessment is it's very grim. It looks very dark, but I believe the future. Now, if the future means the next 25 years, I think we're going to see a revival of pro-capitalist thought and action. Now, you mentioned the, and I stress this in my book too, where have all the capitalists gone? There's an implication there that they used to be here. Where'd they go? It is true that in the last two or three decades of the last century, the move was toward capitalism globally. That's why the Cold War ended. So Reagan, Thatcher, and that whole, what the critics today call neoliberalism, the new case for liberty from Rand to Hayek to Mises to Hazlitt to Friedman to Buchanan. It was a great, great run. And it shows, and that's fairly recent, this isn't centuries ago, it shows that there can be a revival of better ideas and better practice. Now, the last 20 years have gone the other way. There's no doubt about that. And it shows that the case for capitalism made at the last part of the last century wasn't fully made. The collapse of the socialism was recognized as, well, there's a problem with socialism, but that doesn't mean people embraced the full case for capitalism. Back to this issue of whether it's a system or not. Yeah, they might have said it produces the goods, but what did they say? Well, it also produces inequality, and it's unjust, and the rich and the fat cats and cronies are blah, 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 blah. So that is the problem. There's and objectivism is uniquely positioned to solve the problem because it has a moral case for capitalism. So the first thing is capitalism needs a moral case, but it needs a secular moral case. So some conservatives will say this. Some conservatives will conclude that the last 50 years taught us that making the economic case for capitalism isn't enough, and they'll say it needs a moral defense, but their moral defense is religious and altruistic. That's not going to save capitalism. That's what's eroding capitalism. So the two great enemies are the secular Marxists and the religionists who believe capitalism can be defended on Judeo-Christian grounds, and it can't be. Now, I think the last thing I would add to this, and to make it more, because I think it is more of a positive outlook, is the way you put it is we have to convince the majority of the population. I don't think that's true. I think if you look at the history of intellectual movements, for good and bad sets of ideas, it's been a really small minority of intellectuals that have done it. Even the founders, were not the idea of the founding fathers and the revolution in America. I mean, that was not majority supported. But if you have more powerful ideas and you're in the elite, you see that people hate elites these days. There's an anti-elitist trend going on. My colleague Jason Hill has talked about this, you know, that we shouldn't be against elites, the idea of credentialed, knowledgeable, experienced people. We just need better elites. We don't need elites who are buffoons like the kinds we have in power these days. So in that regard, it's a less insurmountable task to say we need new intellectuals. That's what the name of Ayn Rand's book for 1961 was, for the new intellectual. That's what we need. We need many more new intellectuals. But that doesn't mean, you know, a majority of the country, which is 150 million people. If we had 150 solid objectivists in universities, think tanks, and intellectual fields, the world would be one. It doesn't take that many. And from an economic analogy standpoint, it's the equivalent of producing capital goods versus consumer goods. The teachers, professors, and intellectuals are basically the capital goods. If they're good, they will produce a hordes of good people. You can try to go retail, so to speak. You can try to do podcasts, and you can try to do things through journalism and elsewhere. But the problem we have today, if you think about it, it's the elites that people say, what the heck has happened with the elites? They've all gone woke. It's not the American people who've gone woke. And everybody knows this stuff came from the universities to begin with and has spread out into the major institutions since then. So I know that sounds like a lot, but it does mean that as long as we can penetrate and influence the intellectuals, which are a small fraction of the total population, we have a better chance of winning. And I think it's very doable. We have reason and reality on our sides, and they don't. And notice the more they push their view, the more ridiculous they look. But there's still, that's not enough. It's not enough, just as it wasn't enough for the Soviet Union to fail and then everybody embraced capitalism. That's not what happened. It's not enough for these woke people to make themselves ridiculous and then assume everyone will run to reason. That's not true. One of the reasons we have this today, this postmodernist culture that my colleague Stephen Hicks has written about. I mean, he's the one who wrote the book on postmodernism in 2004. He totally foresaw this. It isn't just a anti-capitalism. It's anti-reason down the line. It's anti-modernity down the line. It's anti-enlightenment down the line. And that's what we have to be advocating: reason, self-interest, and individualism loudly, proudly, and logically, consistently. And there's just not enough of us doing that well enough, I think.
Need a capitalist pride month. I just first want to thank, I see that we have 12 shares of this room, which is fantastic. If you haven't shared it yet, I would be very grateful if you would. It's that little share button at the bottom, share it on Clubhouse, Twitter, Facebook. Let's start making more capitalists. Patrick. Patrick, you want to unmute?
Yes, sorry. Hey, Richard. I kind of wanted to follow up on JP's question because I had an idea. I was developing like a scripted narrative about these two aliens that come to Earth and visit it over different periods. And my presumption was going to be sort of that capitalism, you know, describing it as a system in some ways is like, well, okay, well, the Earth's water cycle is a system. But then also, like, whether I use DSL, fiber optic, or some other thing is a system. But they seem to be, like, two different kinds of systems. You know, one is, like, designed, and I pick it. And the other one seems to be context-dependent. So my notion was, well, in the same way that on an alien world, there must be a Newton who discovers how gravity works, right? Or else they wouldn't advance and, you know, be able to go to space. Then similarly, we would see the various other things if they're, you know, similar to our nature, let's say on this planet, like it's a, you know, they're bipedal, the gravity, et cetera. So they wouldn't they sort of discover things like money? I mean, there's not really an alternative to money. There's just money. And then wouldn't they sort of discover contracts, insurance, like markets? It's sort of like, it's not that they just designed a system and you kind of can pick amongst the systems. There's sort of a system that contextually, given our nature, just is the natural order of human beings. Now, I suppose we could change up the goal and say, well, our goal is to kill all the humans and have Earth flourish, or our goal is total equality. But that's sort of an artificial imposition. Like, in some ways, I mean, would you say that capitalism is an artificial system, or is something that we impose, or is it kind of like a discovery process of something natural that is just part of who we are if we want to be have more humans who are having more wealth and capability?
Well, there's a great question, Patrick. There's two strands of what you're saying that I've heard over and over again, which could be very helpful to disentangle, because I think it actually is setting back the liberty movement. And the first distinction I'm hearing, I hope I get close to what you're saying here, but I've seen it in other dimensions. One is system. Is a system designed deliberately, or is this a spontaneous manifestation? And the second thing I'm hearing from you is it natural or artificial? Now, sometimes those overlap. People will say, hey, if it's designed, then it's artificial. If you just like let it run and it's spontaneous, then it's natural. Now, here's how I conceive of capitalism. It's natural in the sense that it is the system that is consonant with human nature. So the phrase I use when I talk to environmentalists is it's the optimal habitat for humanity. Just as we think of a fish out of water, why is that concept in our mind? Because a fish needs water. Well, like similarly, humans need capitalism, and it's really true historically. They suffocate and starve and die in anti-capitalist settings. It's just a fact, right? Now, why isn't that a fact widely recognized by humans to the point where they're all pro-capitalist? Because they have free will, because they don't always go by reason. I would say, however, if you look at the American experiment, it was designed. It was deliberately designed in Philadelphia. It was debated. It was instituted. And so I think as pro-liberty people, we should not be, and I think many of them are, we should not be suspicious of the idea of designing something, structuring something. I think of constitutionalism and all the theories about divided powers and checks and balances, the kind of things that Montesquieu, Locke, and the founders taught us, is kind of like political engineering. And we need political engineering, else the building will collapse or the bridge will collapse, you know, or a country can collapse if its constitutional lattice, so to speak, isn't created properly. So that's all designed, but the key is to make sure it's designed rationally. It doesn't mean it's imposed. If it's a design that fits the human nature, then it's great. Now, it isn't to say that certain things don't occur spontaneously within a system, within a structure. That's the wonderful thing about capitalism. If you don't have anarchy, if you have a system of limited government that protects rights and otherwise leave people free to do their thing, so to speak, as long as they go by reason, you're going to get great results. So I think I know where you're going, and I would just endorse both sides. Namely, we do have to put some thought into this. We do have to create institutions knowingly, consciously, deliberately create institutions that promote human survival and flourishing. It ain't just going to happen for no reason. Now, one of the reasons, by the way, I say this has held back the liberty movement, I have debated with libertarians sometimes about reform, the idea of reform, changing things, you know, and reformers are typically on the left. I mean, they are typically the ones trying to, you know, reform capitalism and change it and this and that. And when you get a mixed economy and you make any attempt to intervene and have government policy go the other way and become more capitalist, there are many libertarians who will just say, hands off, don't do anything. And so the bias goes toward those who would intervene to promote statism, and you can't get any, you can't get any background or support for reforms that bring it the other way. And so that's a problem. Those who say just hands off, don't do anything, and everything will turn out for the best is something holding back pro-capitalist reforms, I think. I hope that helps.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Patrick, how are those strips coming?
Working on it.
This is David. Can I just jump in for a second with Richard? I want to raise a question for you about the drift of a lot of discussion here has been what's the future and what we can do to, you know, shift it in a good direction. I absolutely agree with your point that the moral basis of capitalism has to be promoted and established. That's the biggest problem. I think altruism is number one cause of socialist ideas. But I've been thinking for years about whether there's a psychological problem here too, and I'd love to hear your comment. The psychological issue is that people accommodate to whatever their circumstances are, and one of the circumstances is the welfare state. So people, Americans still have a strong individualist streak, the don't tread on me attitude. And yet they're used to Social Security, they're used to public education, they're used to any number of all the socialist things that have been part of their lives for generations now. And they take them for granted. And there's this underlying psychological thing is, you offer someone escape from responsibility for his own life, and that is attractive to a lot of people who don't get the entrepreneurial approach to life, which sees responsibility as a positive thing, and don't want someone taking care of them. But a lot of people, you know, just fall for that. So, have you thought about ways of addressing that issue, the psychological issue of taking back responsibility?
Great point, David. Thank you so much for participating. I teach a freshman seminar at Duke called Capitalism For and Against, and one whole section is devoted to the psychology of it. And I do think this is really important. By the way, this is another reason to think of it more as a system. So even if you get the politics, economics, and culture right, if the psychology isn't there, it's not going to work either. So I think what is the key objectivist contribution here? Brandon Rand and others on the psychology of self-esteem. So self-esteem, of course, implies something about self-interest, selfishness, the self. The self as an independent being, you know, with independence and all the great virtues. And you're absolutely right. If you have a culture, which we have today, which is predominantly dependency, or some of us have seen it or classified it as paternalism, paternalism in politics is the analogy that the state is the father and mother, the citizens are children, they're going to be told what to do, they're going to be taken care of, however. When you get that in politics, you're not going to have a free society. And you're certainly not going to get leaders who care about you as much as mommy and daddy did. I mean, mommy and daddy created you. They care about you more than Chuck Schumer does. People don't seem to realize that. But I think you're absolutely right, David, that the welfare state itself, you think about it, what do they call it? The social safety net. The nanny state. I mean, the fact that it's even called the nanny state, the citizens need a nanny. If you don't produce people with reason, self-esteem, self-efficacy, they're going to be fearful. They're going to be phobic. They're going to be, please, Anthony Fauci, tell me what to do with my mask. Now, people do push back, but the fact that these policies have become so ingrained in our culture, yes, you're right, is a psychology issue. So, literature on of the type that Brandon produced, psychology of self-esteem, very important. I think that's kind of been lost within objectivism. There isn't as much stuff on psychology being explicated these days and the problem associated with this dependency welfare state. Another great essay out there, by the way, the Psychological Requirements of a Free Society by Edith Packer. Oh, I think from the mid 80s or so. Not an easy essay to find, but if you can get your hands on it, that's a beauty. It's like five major principles that a person would have to have in their psychology to want to live in a free society. And to lack these, she says, you're going to feel uncomfortable in a free society. You are literally going to feel anxious and worried. Because you don't have this intellectual, psychological, emotional equipment. So it's a really good point, David. I'm not a psychologist, but I do notice that unless you have a citizenry, and not just a citizenry, the elites themselves are not always psychologically sound. You're not going to get a free society.
Richard, thank you. And Jack, just a note here. Maybe we can find that essay by Edith Packer. I think I read it back in the day, but it is, if we could recover it or maybe get permission from George. We could promote it a bit.
I have my students read that essay. And it's an eye opener to them because it's simultaneously a kind of self-help essay too. If you have these certain psychological traits, you're going to do better in life. But the broader point she makes is, and you'll be a citizen that wants to live in a free society. You won't be risk averse, you won't be phobic, you won't be living in your mother's basement, literally. So it's a big issue, big deal.
All right. We are on it, David. We'll get that. Jason, thanks for your patience.
I just want to first start off and say thank you, Richard, for doing this with the room. I've heard you speak a couple times, and I've loved every time that I've got to hear you speak. I've learned a lot, and I've appreciated your insight and your perspectives.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. And so I've got a question today because I've been grappling with this for a while. I've been a part of the Liberty Movement for a little over 10 years now. And this is one of the questions that, you know, I struggle with because I can see both sides. And so I'd be interested in your input. And so understanding from Thomas Sowell, who said, you know, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. When it comes to innovation, there is the aspect of intellectual property and patents and everything else. And so within your perspective and moving forward and trying to have a capitalist, not system per se, but a capitalist ideology, being able to help prevail and bring through innovations to the markets, whether that's in healthcare, in just general engineering or whatever, what have you. How does intellectual property play into this? Is it, of course, when we look at the current standing, right, many argue that intellectual property has too much protections over time. People have argued that there needs to be more in some markets. Where is that line for the capitalist perspective pertaining to some of the bigger markets that we have?
Now, thank you, Jason. Good question. I think the case for private property rights includes the case for IP. patents and copyrights. But it is true, if you're alluding to this, it is true that in the liberty movement, there's a debate over this. And some argue, even Hayek argued this, that there should not be strong patent and copyright protections. I think he said in one essay there shouldn't even be a copyright, copy trademark for Coca-Cola and other things like that. I think this is a crucial part of property rights, but they can't be indefinite and interminable, that's for sure. So the idea of limiting the time frame, which is long in the literature, is not new to me, is an issue as well. But I think without that, you can't have full innovation. If innovation is kind of your practical hope, there isn't going to be as much innovation if you don't protect property rights generally, but then including intellectual property. So, but apart from the practical consequences, it's just the right thing to do. It's just the moral thing to do. Since our time is limited, I think it's best for me to just recommend to people probably the best IP intellectual and historian in the country is Adam Mossoff, Mossoff. Adam is an objectivist law professor at George Mason University at the Scalia School, I believe. If you just look up Mossoff and patents and intellectual property, he's got a bunch of amazing essays and books, and he debates other libertarians about this and about the importance of it. But I do think the case for capitalism is weakened by libertarians who say to hell with intellectual property rights. You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, this the timing of this room is working out really well. We've got 8 more minutes. And Thomas, thanks for your patience.
Hello. Hello. Thanks, Richard. It's a very interesting topic for me because I am a kind of guinea pig. I lived under the communism in Poland, and now I am living under capitalism. And so I have maybe a slightly different perspective because maybe it's oversimplified view, my view, but I think that the trouble with capitalism is that products are divided unjustly and there is an equality. But the trouble with socialism and communism is that there is a lack of products, so we don't have a trouble in injustice because there is nothing to be divided. So if I think that speaking cynically, the communist countries which are nowadays as Venezuela or Cuba are very needed because as a beggar on the street, the view of the beggar is evidence what could happen to you when you are behaving not very wisely. So maybe the question for you, Richard, is it morally properly to think like that Venezuela or Cuba are needed to make evidence to tell people that they shouldn't take a welfare state for granted, as David pointed out previously, and they should remember that products must be invented by someone, that risk might be taken by someone. And the economy is kind of a roller coaster. When people are forgetting about that truth, economy is going down. And when they are recalled that somebody should take risk, things are going better. So that's the question. Should we have such a situation that we should be remembered, maybe organizing trips to those countries to show people how the economy is going under socialism. Thanks.
Thanks, Thomas. I think the essay that comes to mind most that I've written recently on this is something called "We Should Celebrate Diversity and Wealth Too." So if you look that up, you'll find it on the internet. We should celebrate diversity and wealth too. And I mention that because you mentioned that something like capitalism seems okay, but the products are divided unjustly and there's inequality. I think to be pro-capitalist, you have to be pro-inequality. You have to be unapologetically a fan of and extol the unequal results that occur. And as long as we have, and this is part of capitalism, equality before the law, equal treatment before the law. But if you treat people equally before the law, if you apply the laws equally to all, regardless of their skin color, gender, ethnicity, and all that, people are different. They're diverse. They choose different paths, choose different jobs, different occupations. There will be differential results that we should be celebrating. In this particular essay, I note how we tend to celebrate this when it occurs in the arts. We see Academy Awards. We celebrate it when we see it in sports. We see champions. We have fanatics who love champions. But for some reason, in the commercial realm, when there's unequal results, people don't extol the great producers. Now, if they're personalized in the form of, say, people like Donald Trump, who built buildings, or Elon Musk, who built car companies, that notice that the more tangibly you see what their production is, they are admired. Some of them are hated, but it's the CEO who people have no idea what they're doing that is the real trouble, because they think the CEOs are just sitting around shuffling paper, not producing anything. So that would be the first thing I would say. In a world where people are treated equally before the law, you should expect to see differential performance, and we should be applauding diversity in commercial realm, not just in arts and in sports. Now, I disagree with you when you say, well, in socialism, at least, there isn't a problem of justice. There's just a lack of product. Well, that's a total result of injustice. I mean, those things there, there's massive injustice because they won't leave people free to produce. So I disagree with you that just because you find equal misery and equal poverty in socialist regimes, that therefore they're just. I mean, you're defining justice, I think, in an egalitarian manner, and therefore classifying capitalism as unjust because it has unequal wealth, and socialist regimes as just, or at least not unjust, because they don't have unequal wealth. So I reject that entirely.
Yeah, you are right. You get that point, because even in Orwell, it was saying, we all are equals, but some are more equal.
Right.
It was like that.
Right.
As I said, I oversimplified the things because.
That's okay.
Thanks.
Thanks, Thomas.
Yeah. Can I add something? When Richard Scott.
Go ahead.
When Thomas was saying, that. It's all equal because in socialism, nobody has anything. That's actually not true. Just as Thomas eventually said in Animal Farm, the pigs supposedly divide and then they stole the barley and made the alcohol out of the barley, and then they secretly enjoyed the barley that's prohibited, that's forbidden to the general population of the animals. And you can see this exactly reflected the situation state in the socialism in the Soviet Union and in communist China. The higher ups, the higher officials, had their special provisions. Prohibited from the enjoyment of the general populace, and it is divided in the loot are divided according to the ranks, and they have special treatment, food, special.
To jump in here, we're actually just at time, so I'm very sorry, Hansen, to interrupt you, but we can continue this conversation on a future Clubhouse. if you go to the Atlas Society website, sign up, you will get updates on our events. We have several a week. Next week, I am going to be having a conversation with Ian Miller. He is author of Unmasked, and he's been a longtime critic of mask mandates and lockdowns. So that quote by Thomas Sowell was deeply resonant there. And then, of course, on the 23rd, the link is up there, is Professor Salzman's Morals and Markets. I believe that is true. Lawrence, correct me if I'm wrong. And then on Friday, we'll have a clubhouse with Jason Hill. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.